Welcome back to another episode of Dan Has a Plan Beyond the Balance Sheet. I'm Daniel B. Smith, a financial advisor on the Family Wealth Management team at UBS Financial Services. I'm joined by my daughter, Alana J. Smith.
Surprise, surprise.
We're located in Paramus, New Jersey, and I can be reached at daniel.b.smith@ubs.com. Our guest expert today is Dr. Vinny Costa. He is an emergency medical physician at Montefiore Medical Center. He is not affiliated with UBS Financial Services, and his views are his own.
Okay, we're talking emergency medicine today. I know it's not the most fun idea, having a medical emergency, but we got to talk about it.
Exactly. So medical emergency. Let me just throw a couple of examples that have happened to me over my career.
Oh no, I'm so scared. Okay.
People are cruising a lot.
They're on cruises. At sea.
And they often overlook getting the proper medical coverage when they're on the cruise.
This is such a funny place to start, but okay.
All right. So imagine that you wake up and you have appendicitis.
Oh, no.
And you say you're in Tahiti.
Like not even on land. No. In the waves, amongst the sea animals. What are you going to do?
Exactly. The first thing I usually say when people go on cruises is, do we have medical coverage for anything that might happen?
Is it different than traveling abroad?
Yes, it is. I have not been on a cruise.
Yeah, I don't think that's for you. Being on land, I feel like is better.
Yeah, I'm kind of a land guy.
Me too.
Barely tolerate the air.
Yeah, me too. But yeah, you bring up an important point. A medical emergency when you're traveling can be astronomical if you don't have the proper insurance.
Not only that, there are rare circumstances where people pass away or in the Red Sea. And that is another whole layer of expense. And now these are things that are perhaps far-fetched, but paying a little bit of an insurance premium to counteract that would certainly make your financial planner happy.
All right. So leaving cruises for a second, let's go back to land. Here at Dan Has a Plan, we love a plan. You can't plan for emergency.
No, but think of it like this. When I talk to people during a normal client meeting, I ask them how they're feeling. How's their health? How's their family's health? There's a couple components of a financial plan that are predicated on health, one of which is life insurance. Generally speaking, I only do term life insurance, which is for income replacement for the loss of a spouse or partner. And or paying off debt, but you need to have good health to get the best rates.
They won't give you a good rate if you're in poor health.
That's correct.
It'll be more expensive.
The second thing is long-term care insurance. You know, we'll probably have a show dedicated strictly to long-term care insurance. Generally speaking, age 55 to 60 is kind of the sweet spot to start thinking about that.
So let's take it back to regular health insurance and talk about where a medical emergency fits into your plan. Because I think a lot of people go into health insurance and whether it's through their job or not, it's like overwhelming to try and pick a plan and make sure you're covered for what you need.
Yeah. The most common thing that's happening in today's marketplace for people who work at companies and they have company insurance, A, they have to pay into it. And secondly, they're going to what are called high deductible plans.
Oh, yeah.
Let's just say you're in a plan that has a $10,000 deductible. Basically what that means, it's on you for the first 10 G's out of pocket.
For anything, emergency or not.
Correct. Once you get to that $10,000 level, then generally a large part of the insurance is paid.
But that's just within a year.
It's per calendar year, correct. The deductible restarts after that first year or on the anniversary date of your policy. Planning for a emergency fund of $10,000 is smart.
There you go.
You have your deductible covered. So if you have to go through some medical circumstance, it's not going to interrupt the daily cash flow. Second thing is there's a couple of type of accounts that help with this. One of them is called a health savings account. An HSA, you can put away a few $1,000s a year pre-tax for times when, you know, you submit a claim and the insurance company pays X and there's a small balance left over due to the deductible and or otherwise, you have a resource where you can use pre-tax dollars to pay for those events. The nice part about HSA is that it can carry forward. So if you don't use it all in 1 year, you don't lose it. It stays accessible for you. The second piece of that is that you can actually invest the money.
So it grows.
Yes, you can potentially grow that money. Where people use this a lot is, I'm always going into my mid-age crowd, but when people are preparing to go on Medicare, maybe for the 10 years before they go on Medicare, they start building up their HSA account.
So have a nest egg, HSA. What about FSA?
Well, FSA, the difference is it has to be used during the calendar year.
And okay? FSA stands for?
A flexible spending account. There's one specifically for childcare, which is very helpful for people bringing up young children because they're in daycare. So you're using pre-tax dollars to pay for these types of services. But tying it back into Dr. Vinny today, healthcare is changing so fast, number one. Number two, I want to bring the audience attention to what it takes to become a doctor, because everybody says, well, my son, I want him to be a doctor. Well, let's hear from Vinny what it takes.
Right.
Okay, not only time-wise, education-wise, but money-wise.
All right, great. I think that's our cue to welcome Dr. Vinny Costa.
The Dr. Vinny Costa. So Alana J. Smith, we have the Dr. Vinny Costa with us today.
Oh, royalty. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So Doc, here's where I'd like to start today. What is the academic road to becoming an emergency room doctor?
It is a long one.
So in high school, 4 years of high school, obviously, do you have to have any academic path?
Typically in high school, if you know already that you'd like to go down the medicine path, you can at least focus on the sciences. And then once you get to undergraduate, that's where you really should theoretically start zeroing in on all the prerequisites for medical school, which you can do the traditional route, which is major in something like biology, chemistry, biochemistry, in which case all of the courses you're taking for your major will be the same ones you'll need to get into medical school. But you could also major in something outside the sciences and then just make sure you do those prerequisite courses for medical school.
Where did you go to undergrad?
Drew University in Madison, New Jersey.
Very familiar with Drew University. Great
Excellent school.
Yeah.
I had a great time there.
In your circumstance, when did the light go off that maybe you wanted to go further?
In high school, I always was drawn towards the sciences, the biology, the chemistry. And then my dad's a podiatrist, so I had a little bit of exposure to office work, patients, physicians, sort of relationship there. And then once I got into college, I really loved the sciences and I loved being healthy and active, and it all kind of intertwined and meshed well for me to become a physician.
So you graduate from Drew and you don't just point at a school and say, I'm going there.
So there's the MCAT is the test that we all had to take. And then similarly to when you apply for college, you apply to medical schools also. There's some competitive ones. There's some not competitive ones. There's some that are foreign countries that people go to if they can't get into United States medical schools.
Oh boy.
Yeah, that's a very common route for people who don't get accepted into a medical school in the United States. But typically you'll apply to a lot of medical schools in the U.S. to help increase your chances of getting in. And the same thing, application process, interviews, and the like.
How many medical schools are there in the United States?
If I had to guess off the top of my head, I would say somewhere around 150, 200, something like that.
Really? So it's not that many?
It's not that many.
Wow. So what was your particular path?
I grew up in Rockland County. I went to New Jersey for college. So most of my family and friends were local. So I wanted to stay somewhat local. So I applied to medical schools all in the tri-state area. I wound up being accepted to Stony Brook University out on Long Island.
Oh, nice.
Great. And did you have an idea of what you wanted to specialize in, or you went in blind?
I went in without an idea. I very much early on in the process leaned toward emergency medicine, but I went in with an open mind.
What was it? Just the excitement of it all?
There was the excitement and more so the variety. I kind of get bored very easily. So if I don't have, you know, the stimulation of 15 things happening at once.
That's who you want in an emergency.
Exactly. Multitasker.
Yes.
Yeah, that's essentially what we get paid to do, to multitask.
Wow.
So you go to Stony Brook for 4 years. What's the first year compared to the fourth year?
Typically, and these are all fluid and changing as medical education evolves, but typically the first 2 years are your basic sciences, classroom work, anatomy lab, learning textbooks, readings, and tests. And then the third and fourth year, you're doing your clinical rotations. So you practice a month in pediatrics, a month in surgery, a month in OBGYN, et cetera. Get a little bit of all the different fields to help you pick what you think you would like to do the best. So at the end of medical school, you need to choose which specialty you're going to do a residency in. That's what we call the training in a specific field.
So in your case, you wanted the emergency medicine.
Yes.
You wanted the hot seat.
Yes.
Where did you do your rotation for ER?
So I rotated in the emergency room at Stony Brook Hospital, the main campus. I did a rotation at Peconic Bay Medical Center, which is out even further eastern Long Island as well. When you apply for your residency, this process is actually pretty wild. You rank a list of your most desired residencies that you want to get into, and you put them one through however many places you got interviewed at. And then the hospital ranks all of the medical students that they interviewed from their favorite to their least favorite. And some sort of computer algorithm matches however many slots each hospital has, the appropriate number of
That's students. The match.
And there's a one day in March every year, match day, where everyone finds out. They open an envelope traditionally and find out where you're going to spend your residency.
Match day is like a huge day.
Yeah, it is.
I've never heard of the match day.
Yeah. Emergency medicine residency is typically shorter than some of the other fields. So if you decide to go into certain specialties, you could be getting a 5, 6, 7 year residency. So that envelope will tell you where you're going to be living for the next half a decade. So that's why there's a lot of...
So you're basically 26 years old and you get this envelope.
Yeah. Yep.
Right? Okay. So you open the envelope and where's Dr. Vinny going?
So I matched at the time, it was called St. Luke's and Roosevelt Hospital in Manhattan on the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Wow.
Now affiliated and part of Mount Sinai.
So happy, sad.
It was awesome. It was my first choice and it was an amazing 3 years. It was awesome.
So low man on the totem pole. What's the schedule for the first month?
Yeah. The first year is the classic intern year that you've probably heard of before. And those hours are traditionally very long hours. It's not uncommon to do 6 straight 12-hour overnight shifts. That's like what a brutal stretch of your schedule would be like.
Okay.
You also are rotating not just in the ER, but in other parts of the hospital too. So for example, you do rotation in the ICU and those blocks are also very long hours, sometimes 16-hour days. Some rotations in the hospital also you can do a 24-hour shift. They've started to limit how long doctors can be awake for, but...
Wow.
Can you talk a little bit about financially what it costs to go through all of that? You're like, are you getting paid to be a resident?
So I guess we can take one step back to medical school because even medical schools can vary significantly on how much tuition costs. Sort of analogous to undergraduate, there are state medical schools. Stony Brook is part of the SUNY system. Upstate is in Syracuse, SUNY Upstate, SUNY Downstate's in Brooklyn. So there are New York State medical schools which have in-state tuitions, which are significantly less than a private medical school.
Sure.
Those are few and far between. They also, over the years, have become much more competitive as people realize that I can get pretty much same education at two different medical schools with the cost of tuition being half at one compared to the other.
Right.
So residency is the first time where you start getting paid.
Okay.
Typically, the starting salary for an intern is somewhere between maybe $70,000 and $90,000, which is certainly, you know, a good starting salary. When you break it down to how much you're getting paid per hour, it winds up not being so high.
Yeah.
And, you know, medicine is kind of unique in that you go through this period of medical school where your tuitions can be upwards of $100,000 a year at some places, some private medical schools. You're paying that tuition during medical school. Then you go to residency. You're finally getting your first paycheck. You're honestly working so often, it's hard to spend a lot of money other than just your living expenses because you don't really have time to do much.
Right.
And then once you finish your residency and become a full-fledged attending physician, then your salary increases substantially. And that's when you can start paying back your loans and saving for down payments on houses and the like.
Just because I have to do a lot of surgery in my business from a planning perspective, and it's the liability side we're talking in this case, I see a lot of students that are healthy six figures, and that's just for undergrad.
Mm-hmm.
Loan-wise, you mean?
Loan-wise. I do see physicians with upwards of $1 million in debt. I mean, I've seen it.
It's crazy, but true.
Yeah, it is true. If you were to take a cross-section of your class at Stony Brook when you were in med school, what percentage of the people came out of there with no debt?
A small percentage. This is actually published data that you can look up. I do know that the average loan burden for graduating medical students is roughly $250,000.
Okay.
And that gets skewed because, like you said, some people have $1 million and some people, either their parents paid for everything or whatever may have you, and they may have $0. So that's the average, but I would say a small percentage of them have $0.
So when you see a patient come in, there's the local ambulance corps. We see on all the medical shows, you know, they give you the blood pressure, the respiratory rate, their cursory view of what's wrong. Is that basically how it happens?
There are patients where the ambulance will call the hospital ahead and say, hey, we're bringing in this patient who's got chest pain and we're concerned they're having a heart attack. We're concerned they're having a stroke. Those are patients they'll call ahead before they bring them. If it's not a true critical life-threatening emergency, they won't call ahead. bed. They'll bring them to the hospital. They'll bring the patient into the emergency department. They'll get seen by the nurse who will take their vitals, get a very brief, like you said, history on what's going on, and they see the doctor. Every emergency department will have a separate entrance for the ambulance and a separate entrance for what we call the walk-in patients, drive to the hospital. And there's separate nursing teams at those entrances who will assess the patient and do the vital signs and get their story. And based on those, they'll assign them a level of acuity, meaning a level of seriousness from 1 to 5. 1 being you're having a heart attack and you're going to die. 5 being you stubbed your toe, need a Band-Aid sort of situation.
Do you see people making decisions about whether or not to take an ambulance based on a financial circumstance?
It's a good question. I don't necessarily know whether they do or don't based on their financial circumstances, but I do know the threshold for what one person calls an ambulance for is completely different than what someone else would call it for. You'll have a patient, like you said, who can barely breathe, who drove in their car, parked it in the parking lot, walked up the ramp to the hospital to get seen, and you'll have somebody who hurt their, sprained their ankle playing soccer and called an ambulance. I would say if you're having symptoms of something that could be life-threatening, like a heart attack or a stroke or something like that, sure, I think that's reasonable to call an ambulance. For things other than that, you can get seen just as fast if you just drive to the hospital.
I ask because I saw on social media that someone had called an ambulance, got the bill, didn't have insurance when they first called the ambulance, got insurance at some point between the ambulance call and getting the bill, calls their insurance company and says, this was going to cost me less if I didn't have insurance because there was some kind of deal. Like if you weren't covered, this is the cost of the ambulance. And then as soon as he got covered, it cost more.
Wow.
Crazy.
That is crazy. The intersection between medicine and the insurance world is very complex. You've probably seen over the years less and less mom and pop shops for any sort of medical specialty and more so affiliated with Hospital X. I'm part of this hospital system now.
Right, yeah.
And most of that comes down to insurance companies when they're negotiating their rates of reimbursement. When you have an entire hospital system, they can negotiate a better rate for that hospital system on reimbursement. Whereas if you're just a mom and pop shop, you're not going to bring them enough business. They'll tell you, you know, kind of get lost, or they'll say your rates are less. And then it's hard for that single office to stay afloat.
Wow.
There you have it. So I have a couple of Dan Smith first aid things. I just figured I would throw them out at you. This is probably the comedic part here.
Dan has a plan to start a podcast so he can get all his questions answered.
So one thing I know is, because I went through this recently, this is a true story. I went golf at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a 95 degree humid day, and I definitely was underhydrated when I went out. By the time I ended, I was a little dizzy and I had an insatiable thirst, and I couldn't bring my body temperature down, even being in front of the air conditioning.
Wow.
So I was like pouring water on my head. And after I came home, my wife said to me, get up in the shower and turn it on cold. So good advice, bad advice.
Yeah, this is good for the summer.
Yeah, that's good advice. Typically, the ways to cool yourself down the fastest is obviously drinking the cold water would help. Putting any sort of cold ice packs on the typical points of your body you think would get overheated, you know, the back of your neck, the armpits, those are areas that can help cool your core temperature the fastest.
Right. Great. Pro tip.
So number two is the lady to my left here put us through a little something where she...
I don't even know what he's going to say.
What was it that you ate that you developed hives?
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of allergies.
Was it kiwi?
Yeah.
Okay. She had
but that was early on. That
she
was
had
like
kiwi,
two.
And we were frantically running around the neighborhood looking for Benadryl. So I'm a big Benadryl fan.
Yes. Okay. I think that's a good thing to have in everyone's medicine cabinet at home.
Put it in your purse. I carry it around.
Yeah, even better.
So the third one is this. My family history is my dad, his two brothers, and my grandfather all had coronary bypass surgery. Mm-hmm. So I've been on a lifelong preemptive cardiac care. But one of the things that I take every day is a baby aspirin. But I've also heard if you feel you're in a cardiac episode, that taking an aspirin can, prior to like an ambulance coming, can be of assistance. Is that a wise tale? I'd like to have Dr. Vinny's viewpoint on that.
That's very accurate also.
Okay. So can you give me the medical reason why?
Sure. So there's a handful of treatments when you're having a heart attack that are proven to help prevent that heart attack from progressing. And one of them is aspirin, which is an antiplatelet. So basically what happens when you have a heart attack is you've got some plaque in your arteries that supply blood to your heart. The plaque ruptures, it causes a clot, and then no blood can then be pumped out of that artery. So if you take an aspirin, then that will help decrease the amount of aggregation to that clot. You know, the classic heart attack is the pain on the left side of your chest, you know, the elephant sitting on your chest, the squeezing of your chest can radiate to your jaw, can radiate down your arm. It can be accompanied by nausea and vomiting.
And I've heard that the symptoms can be different for men and women.
Definitely, yeah. Typically, men will present with those classic symptoms that we just described, and women can present atypically. They can have just maybe some pain at the very center of their chest in the lower part. That's about it.
Wild, yeah.
How did you navigate through the COVID crisis? How was doctoring different during that time?
Yeah, it was crazy, especially in New York City. Had to learn things very quickly on the fly. Initially, we didn't know enough to know about the protective equipment that we were supposed to have. We didn't have enough of it. We didn't know how often we're supposed to change it. We didn't have enough for everyone. Every other shift, you get a new mask sort of thing. So for the beginning, it was crazy because not only were the patients coming in sick, but then all of the staff was getting sick. And there was that month, 2 month, 3 month period where the entire department was basically a COVID zone and then a handful of patients who were not there for COVID. You know, it was horrible because patients' families weren't allowed in. So a lot of what we do is if we don't get a great story from the patient, we talk to their family member who's with them. They give us some background or corroborate their story, but we weren't talking to anyone because they weren't there. And then after a couple months, when the world shut down, then just the volumes in ERs just shut down. Everyone was too afraid to leave their house. Everyone was honestly didn't get sick as much because they weren't going anywhere doing anything. And then for a couple month period, the ERs were like a ghost town.
Wow.
Do you enjoy the diagnostic part of it? People come in and you're trying to
figure the puzzle out.
Yeah. I do like the diagnostic part of it. Yeah, I've always been a problem solving mind. It's fun for me. You know, it's like you said, it's kind of like a puzzle. I would say that the hardest patient group to diagnose and figure out what's going on is the youngest, right? From when they're born to when they're 5, 6, when they're truly able to articulate what's going on. The good news is that age group typically is extremely resilient. They bounce back very well from illness. They oftentimes don't get sick for the same exact illness that someone who's older than them will, which is great because sometimes we don't know what's wrong with them and we send them home saying everything looks okay. If it gets worse, come back thing. And that usually works out well. Once they hit, I would say from 20 to 65, it's pretty similar. You can get good histories from them. Their exams are reliable. You can figure out pretty well what's going on. 65 plus, the reliability of your exams goes down, meaning that if you come in with abdominal pain, if I press on your abdomen, I can pretty much tell what's going on or what could be causing your pain because you're young, you're reliable, you're healthy. You're over 65. Now, just because I pressed in this one area, you're not having pain, doesn't eliminate the possibility that something could be wrong in that area. So everything starts becoming more likely to be bad once you hit that 65 and over.
You excited to be there?
On the threshold.
It hurts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's what happens when you have your daughter on your podcast.
I'm here to roast.
The roast of Dan Smith.
So my wife is a retired physical therapist, and one of the things that got her at the end was paperwork. I can't even fathom what it is to document treating someone.
Yeah, it is extensive. Now there are electronic medical records. More and more smaller electronic medical records are getting taken over by bigger ones, and they're combining and trying to get more uniform throughout, at least regionally, parts of the country.
I've also seen AI come into play already.
Yeah, that's certainly coming into play. There's AI tools that can listen to heart sounds, can listen to lung sounds.
Or I just had like an urgent care visit not too long ago where it listened and recorded all the notes.
Yeah, as you can imagine, it's time consuming to write everything that you discussed.
Yeah.
So first we went from typing everything to now everyone in my department has like a dictation device where you talk into it and then it dictates the words into the medical record. That saves a lot of time. After that is something like you just described where you have somebody who just listens to the conversation and just dictates it for you.
You know, I always say that during a work week, I usually have some type of aha moment where I really feel good about something that happened. Do you have those?
Yeah, I think what most ER docs will tell you what makes them feel good is when you have the patient who is either in extreme pain for some reason that you can fix right away. I dislocated my shoulder and I can't move my arm, chop it off because it's killing me right now. And we can pop it back into place and all of a sudden they can do a push-up and they're like the happiest people in the world. So there's the instant gratification that you can fix somebody's pain. That's kind of one bucket. And the other bucket is just the patient who's concerned about, I must have X because I read about this. Please tell me I'm not having a stroke or a heart attack. And with very good confidence we can exclude that for them. And just the reassurance is what a lot of people need.
Have you noticed the level of intelligence, I guess, of patients is higher now because they can research a lot on their own? Or do you have over-researchers? It's probably both ways, right?
Yeah, I would say it's both ways. I prefer it this way. I'd rather them come in with questions, and I don't mind answering all of the Google research they did before they came to the emergency department. But yeah, and sometimes that makes them come to the ER because they Googled, I have pain over here, and they said, oh my God, you could be having a heart attack.
Can I just tell you one of my pet peeves?
Yeah.
Is that all right?
Of course.
You know. Dan's pet peeves. We should have a separate jingle for Dan's pet peeves.
One of my pet peeves is, in the past, at least when I was growing up, you went to the doctor and he prescribed X. Mm-hmm. With all the advertising on TV, they actually go into the doctor and say, okay, I want that as a medication. I'm sure you take that all in stride, but.
Yes, and certainly happens probably more for primary care doctors. Right. Patients walk into their office and say, you know, I want Ozempic, prescribe me Ozempic, right? Like that happens, I'm sure, all the time. But I get routinely, I have a cough. Can you give me a Z-Pack? And I have the same conversation 100 times a week. I don't think you need a Z-Pack. This cough's going to go away whether you take the Z-Pack or you don't.
We talked a bit about first aid, but if you had to give advice to people at home for like preventable things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's like the one aspect of what medicine should you have with you, right? And I think the Tylenols and the Motrins are the standard where you should start. That helps everything, every ache and pain. The Benadryl, certainly important. The Bacitracin, Neosporin, those are all the essentials that I would have. And then there's kind of what we talked about, the preventative aspect of it, whatever you can do to keep yourself healthy, to prevent yourself from needing to seek medical attention is going to pay off for you tenfold. Some of it is genetics and there's nothing you can do about it. And some people get dealt bad cards and they have to just deal with it. But if there is something you can do to help.
I'm going to just say one more thing.
Go for it.
I have ridden my bike very long distances, and please wear helmets out there. I beg people, wear a helmet. It may not be fashionable, but wear the helmet.
Bikes, the scooters, the electric bikes, the electric scooters, all those things that they ride around in New York City. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Well, we've heard it from the Dr. Vinny Costa.
Right. From the source. Thank you so much. That was great.
No problem.
Yeah. Appreciate your time.
Good over there?
I hope so.
We don't have to take you to the ER? I guess I should say, trigger warning, we're going to talk about some emergency medical situations between the two of us if you don't want to listen to it.
Obviously, I have ER stories, but
I have a few too.
You sure do. So my ER story is I was playing tackle football when I was like 11 and I got tackled and my knee hit a rock and sliced it from east to west. And I looked in there and I go, oh, there's things there I don't want to see.
Oh, no.
Yes. So this is 1971. I was taken to a local doctor in Ilion, New York.
Not a hospital.
Not a hospital.
Just a primary care doctor.
Just a primary care doctor. I went there. I got to go right in. Whereas usually you go there for a 1 o'clock appointment, then at 3:30, they called you in.
Oh, yeah, sure. They took one look at you.
So that was, may he rest in peace, Dr. Merson.
Oh, Dr. Merson.
Dr. Merson from Ilion, New York. Shout out to him.
Get that kid in here. Wait, what happened?
Well, he gave me stitches.
He stitched you right up?
Yeah. If you look at my knee, I had a knee replacement.
Yeah.
It looks so beautiful as compared to my double stacked.
Right.
trying to get my.
It looks like stained glass mosaic up in there.
It looks like Frankenstein.
Oh, that's okay. So you won't be a leg model.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I don't know. I've had some weird ones. I had my tongue stuck in my braces once. That was around the same age you're talking about. You know, the colored bands that are around all the little metal notches. One of them had fallen off. Those colored bands keep them, I don't know what else they do, but they keep them not so sharp. I had eaten dinner, went to get a piece of food with my tongue, and it got caught sideways in my mouth on these braces.
I remember that, and you wouldn't let me rip it out.
Yeah, you offered to rip it out with pliers.
Well, sterilize prior, you know.
Were going to sterilize him?
Yeah.
I don't remember that being a part of the conversation. Anyway, we went to the ER and even the ER doctor was like, oh, this is a doozy.
Well, you remember the vitamin story, don't you?
Remind me.
We used to take a multivitamin when we were young and I used to put the circular pill up to my left nostril just to see if I could suspend it there.
With an inhale?
And I did a...
Oh,
and I thought it was up in my brain.
Sorry, you used to do this all the time?
No, I was just goofing around.
Yeah. Right?
So I didn't go to the emergency room. I didn't go to see Dr. Merson, but we did go see Dr. Golden.
Who was that?
He was my mom's obstetrician, I believe.
Oh my God.
because I was young. I guess he doubled as a pediatrician.
Ilya, New York, what are you doing?
Oh, excuse me. He was in Herkimer. And I remember my dad driving me over and he said, Daniel, don't breathe. Don't breathe.
Just don't breathe.
So he got the longest pair of tweezers. I swear he took out He took out my left eyeball getting this vitamin out.
Not your finest moment.
Yeah, so I didn't want to bring it up in front of Vinny.
No, it's embarrassing.
Wouldn't want to set the wrong example with him.
No, surely not, because since then you've planned better.
We have.
Plan for vitamins. Dan has a plan.
So Dr. Vinny Costa was very informative. He laid it out what the education commitment is, what the monetary commitment is, what the time commitment is once you are working. It's a stressful job, but thank God we have people like him.
Because
our society needs Dr. Vinny's.
Yeah, and you have your clients come in and say, I want my kid to be a doctor. We need those supportive parents too, but then they need a way to plan for helping their kid get started if possible, and a financial plan will do that.
Yeah, and I'm sure his dad, who is in the medical field, he has a brother in the medical field, his wife's in the medical field, so he has a good support system.
All right, so that was Dr. Vinny Costa.
The Dr. Vinny Costa.
All right, till next time. Love you.
Love you.
Presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Incorporated offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Incorporated is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.